Questions.
Not about space physics, but. So.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. How to represent a magnetic field? Just for the last homework assignment, we have a solenoid and the current's increasing, so we have an increasing current that's increasing field equal to B dot. What if we just take the normal magnetic field and then just add on this B dot T?
So you're saying that inside a solenoid, the magnetic field is mu naught Ni. And what's this B dot have to do with that? So if you wanted to, you could convert that to an I dot. Okay. The current is increasing. But the reason I wrote it that way is there's actually no reason to involve I in that problem. It won't hurt. If you want to, you can. But in fact, you can work it all out in terms of just B dot. Because the B dot is going to cause the electric field. So you can get an equation for the electric field in terms of B dot, and the magnetic energy change is going to be in terms of B dot. So there's no real reason to talk about I dot.
Right.
But you can, it won't hurt.
Okay, so. So you're saying talk about the magnetic field just in terms of B dot.
So you understand that B dot is the change in the magnetic field with respect to time.
But then we.
So what we need is the change in the magnetic energy, and we can get that from B dot.
Okay.
And what we need is the Poynting vector, which requires an E, and we can get that from B dot.
Right.
So we can express both sides of what we want in terms of B dot, and then hopefully have it, you know, basically cancel out and prove that it's true for any B dot.
Right.
So this is, I think, number 2 in the handout, which was called chapter 16 or something.
I'll get there eventually.
Before or after the exam?
Oh, before. I haven't started all of them. I'm just going to have to pester you.
Other questions? So we've got a help session tomorrow at 4:15, didn't we say? Something like that. And the.
I
talked to Kyle too, just in case Kyle's lying to us all.
So the exam's on Monday, and you know, that often doesn't work well, right? So be warned.
What do you mean it doesn't work well?
What I think happens is that everyone plans on studying right up until they go to sleep Sunday night. This is an experimental statement, not about this class, but about, you know, 30 years of watching classes. I usually try and avoid exams on Monday. No, we're not going to push it back to Wednesday. It's going to be on Monday. So mostly it's a matter of actually being serious and not. Maybe it's not as bad now that there isn't Sunday night football. I don't know. Maybe it's a fall. That makes perfectly good sense to me. Other questions? So I haven't changed what the exam covers, even though we've got this extra day. So none of what we're talking about here is going to be on the exam. So what do we talk about? Well, the Fresnel equations, which deal with how light reflects from a surface. Mathematically, it's kind of a mess. And therefore, I have assigned it to you as a Mathematica problem, as opposed to doing it myself. Yes? Oh, the Fresnel equations?
Is our final test going to be
I see what you're saying. So this isn't on exam 3, and obviously it wasn't on exam 1 and 2. is the final just going to cover everything that we do in the next whatever it is, 6 days? No. The exam will be cumulative. Well,
like what would be putting all this stuff together, will it be majority of the stuff we recently did? Because I know sometimes professors do that where they,
it's
yeah, so I mean, if I were thinking, I would doubly weight this more recent material, but I never think that hard about it. I pull lots of questions from the old exams, and I think it ends up being about equal coverage, that any particular day has the same probability of ending up on the final. So since Laplace equation has been on every exam so far, it seems like a real shoo-in. Since R prime equations have been on every exam so far, it seems like a really good shoo-in. Your particular question about Fresnel equations, you probably didn't mean it seriously, but no, this is not going to end up on the final. So there are kind of two things you could do with Fresnel equations that I can think of. You could kind of prove them, but it's an algebraic mess. Or you could plug and chug them, but who wants to have a plug and chug problem on a junior level physics test? So no, the only time you're going to see these Fresnel equations is when you work them for homework. The results are actually useful. That is to say, you can learn a lot about a solid by reflecting light off it. It's ellipsometry is the name of that study. But the equations are ugly and non-intuitive. And the results mean pretty much everything you can learn about it is present in these graphs. So for example, I hope you see here that E prime is the opposite of E. That is to say, there's been a phase inversion when we've gone from air to glass. And that's important when you were working those thin film problems back in 2011. Whereas when we go from glass to air, there's no inversion. And we can see that, generally speaking, reflected light is mostly transverse electric polarization. So that's the Polaroid Cool Ray advertisement that I always like to talk about. You can see that we've got basically 100% reflection when we're having glancing reflections. When we're talking about going from air to glass, we have total internal reflection, and what's happening here is R is actually becoming complex. So it's not that there's a inversion or anything as simple as that. There's a general and, in fact, ugly phase between E and E prime in this region where we've got total internal reflection. Well, questions? So this is used stuff, but it's kind of mathematically ugly stuff. So to do Fresnel's equations, all we needed was the simplest version of the boundary equations. If we're actually talking about doing conducting problems, and there's a whole chapter in our book where they're going to talk about reflection and transmission through conducting materials, and I told you I'm only going to do the greatest hits part of that. But here we are deriving what the boundary conditions are, and I think kind of the only surprise is we have to remember this boundary condition for current density, and that means the normal component of E is a little bit trickier than you would have expected. But otherwise, these three equations should look pretty familiar to you for typical sort of boundary conditions. This equation in particular, it's not going to be true in the limit that the conductivity actually goes to infinity. If the conductivity isn't infinite, then there can't be current that goes through this really tiny Amperian loop. But if the conductivity goes to infinity, we can have a finite current through an infinitesimal layer, and then this equation gets modified. In fact, under those conditions, H2 is zero in the conductor. So in the limit of infinite conductivity, which at low frequencies copper approximates, there's going to be no electric or magnetic field propagating through the interior. Notice that G is going to go complex, and what that means is that there's going to be a phase relationship between the driving electric field and the corresponding current. We have kind of two limits that we're going to talk about, the limit where the frequency is low enough so that the velocity is in phase with the electric field, and the opposite limit where the electric field is changing so quickly that the velocity really can't catch up to it. No, so it's the same equation for G, but just two limits. So if omega is small, then we can neglect this term, and that's exactly the formula we had for conductivity from the distant past. If omega is large, we're going to neglect that term, and you know, if we were reading the chapter in the book, we'd do it all. But I don't know, even more so than Fresnel equations, it seems dull and less useful to look at the very general case. So many of you are taking Jim's plasma physics course, and you've run into this plasma frequency. So Jim is thinking about this in the context of ionized gases, but copper is a plasma too. And I'm actually mostly thinking about this in terms of conductors. So here's the equation we had from long ago that both H and E have to satisfy. Without this term, it's just the wave equation. With this term, then what's going to happen is the wave number is going to go complex. And if the wave number goes complex, then we're going to have a damped wave inside the conductor. And there's going to be a corresponding skin depth given by the imaginary part of this K vector. So we work that all through. For this low frequency case, we have field penetration, roughly speaking, by the skin depth. So at low omegas, we can get pretty deep into seawater, and that was the basis of one of the homework questions. If you want to communicate with a sub, which seawater has a moderate conductivity, in order to get the electromagnetic wave to go sufficiently deep, you have to use a sufficiently low frequency. You can't communicate at 1 megahertz with a sub. So the other limit that I think is kind of interesting to look at is to think about gamma rays, where we have a very high frequency. We know that gamma rays go through aluminum just fine, whereas visible light bounces off of aluminum. Kind of what's going on there? Well, the index of refraction, if omega is more than the plasma frequency, then the index of refraction is not complex. It's a perfectly good real number. It's less than 1, which looks a little bit funny. It means the phase velocity is faster than the speed of light. But at least it's real, so there won't be any damping for gamma rays going through our material. So when omega is less than the plasma frequency, then we're going to have a complex index of refraction, which means we're going to have reflection when we try and shine our electromagnetic wave off that plasma. So this is saying that if K is imaginary, so think about K having a term that is IB, then when we multiply it by I, we're going to get minus IBZ. And so for the field to go down by a factor of 1 over E, Z is going to want to equal 1 over B, right? This is going to read E to the minus B times Z. So if Z is 1 over B, the fields will be down by a factor of E. And that's what this penetration depth is talking about. It's the electric field isn't going to be zero at one penetration depth. It's just going to be down by a factor of E. So you can maybe detect things at a few skin depths deep, but
is that an S?
That's a sigma. More questions?
And the one under, oh, that's the same thing.
Yeah. So this is kind of how we derived this. We got the square root of I, and you remember that the square root of I was 1 over the square root of 2, 1 plus I. Incidentally, if you're kind of looking for these formulas in the book, they're there, but now we're kind of skipping and hopping around. So they're somewhat difficult to find.
Is omega's angular frequency?
Omega's always. It's been that way since 191.
Not very many things stay the same.
I agree. Right? F equals ma we throw out, but we hang on to omega equals 2 pi f. So the square root of I is is the number that when you square it, you get I. And it turns out, we showed this, that the square root of I is 1 over the square root of 2, 1 plus I. In terms of kind of the vector diagram that we might have, so if I is this vector here, the square root of I is a vector that's at 45 degrees. Has the same length, but is at 45 degrees. And if you're in doubt about that, just square that and you will get I. Yes. Yes. What is what?
What's
due? Everything.
What?
Everything.
But it says the first two.
It says the first two ASAP, which means the others not ASAP.
Last time
you
said he'd kill us.
What? He said that we don't say it. Was I there?
It wasn't recorded, so I don't know if I said that or not.
No.
It's too distant. It won't be picked up.
So we're going to die if we don't swim. Mm-hmm. That sucks. Those are a lot. You really tacked on extra problems hard on this assignment for this test, don't you? I know people agree with me. Agree?
How would anyone know how much has been assigned since no one's doing them? You had those snow days to catch up. Okay, so you should probably pull out this sheet. So I think you've actually done the same stuff, or more or less. I'm not sure how much Jim bothered to do the algebra. I'm going to bother to do the algebra for what's called the stress tensor. And in the context of your space physics class, this was probably just a piece of the stress tensor that he maybe called the magnetic pressure or something like that. So what is this stress tensor and why do I care so much about it? So if we think about a fish that's going through the water, you know, say at high speeds, not supersonic, but a fairly fast moving fish, what are the forces that are going to be on that fish? Well, we know that there's a pressure force, and we could calculate the force on any little piece of this fish by taking the pressure times the area. There's also probably going to be some frictional force, as it were, due to the viscosity. So for every little scale on the surface of this fish, there's a force that is pushing in due to pressure, and there's a force that's pushing it back. And to get the net force of the water on this fish, what I need to do is to simply integrate up all of those various forces. Now, what's a little bit special about the frictional force is if this is a scale on the fish, there's a pressure force, and we've said that there's also going to be a frictional force. So the force that occurs at that fish scale is no longer perpendicular to that fish scale. It's at an arbitrary angle. But we can write that force, the net force that's on this guy, the sum of this red and this green vector, we can write that force as what's called the stress tensor dotted into the normal.
Can you go over, the red arrow is what?
So the red arrow was the pressure. Right, pressure pushes stuff in, and the green was the, I'll call it the viscous force or the frictional force. If you push water over a surface, it's going to push the surface forward. So that's due to the viscosity of the fluid, the thickness of the fluid. And we know that pressure is a force per area. This viscous force is also a force per area, but it's not in the direction of the normal. It's in a different direction. So if we have a matrix, we can change the direction of the normal so it's pointing in the net direction of the force. So what this stress tensor is, this T is the stress tensor. It's a force per area, but it's also a matrix so that the direction of that force is given to us by dotting the normal of that surface into that guy. So if we're talking about a pressure force, then that would mean that this stress tensor was diagonal, right? Because the force is in, well, actually minus pressure. The force is in the minus direction of the normal. But with this viscosity force, we're going to pick up components that are off the diagonal because in general, the force is not going to be in the direction of the normal. Okay, so stress tensors are great when we're talking about the forces that are in solids where we can have a tangential force and in water. But surprisingly, it's also going to work for electricity and magnetism. I can think about the force on an object as being due to the vacuum having some stress, and I can add up that stress to get the net force on anything that's inside a Gaussian surface. Kind of surprising. So, I don't know, maybe this is kind of an interesting sidelight. It actually usually is not the easiest way to calculate forces. So kind of why bother with the stress tensor if it's interesting but not functionally all that useful? And I think probably the main reason for using it is this guy is the main event in modern theories of physics. So for example, if we're talking general relativity, you probably think about gravity as being due to mass. In the context of Einstein's theory of general relativity, gravity is due to the stress tensor. So stress without mass, which you could have, for example, from an electromagnetic field, that's going to gravitate in Einstein's theory. Okay, so just as we have equations for the electric field that, you know, say the divergence of the electric field is equal to the charge density, the equivalent equation in general relativity, the thing that is the source of the gravitational field, is the stress tensor. So it's nice to know something about stress tensors if you're going to look at any piece of modern physics. I repeat, they're often not a great way of actually calculating forces. They're usually easier ways to do it. But it's a nice sort of point of view that, again, puts the idea that the force is in the field as opposed to the forces in the particles. So we're thinking about the electric field making this stressed vacuum, and that stressed vacuum is what's going to cause the forces. Okay, so my claim is that if I've got, you know, my basic elephant, right, so here's my elephant. If I want to figure out, yeah, I know, it's a pretty bad elephant. That's the ears, this is the trunk. Okay, so much for, if I want to figure out what the force is on my charged elephant, I can just surround him with a Gaussian surface. And if I integrate up over this Gaussian surface, the stress tensor dotted into the normal D area, I'm going to get what the net force is on the elephant. And I hope it's clear that the net electric field at this point is where I'm actually doing this integral is going to be in part due to the charges that are outside, and it's going to be in part due to the elephant, but I don't have to know that. All I have to do is measure the electric field at all of these surrounding points and do this integral, and I can calculate what the net force is on this guy. The force is, of course, a vector. If I take a matrix and dot the normal into it, I'm also going to get a vector. So it's a nice, good vector equation. Incidentally, a notation that I like, it's not all that common, to indicate a matrix is something like that, so that it's a vector that kind of goes both ways, that has both rows and columns. So that's what we're shooting for. We're going to get, as a sidelight of this, the idea that light itself carries momentum. So we're going to be interested in the momentum per volume of light. So we know that light carries energy, it also carries momentum, and what Einstein's theory of relativity guarantees us is in fact that the momentum of light better equal the energy divided by the speed of light. So that all should come out as part of doing this this calculation. So the starting point for this work is going to be to look at the force. And typically, if we've calculated the forces on objects, we have multiplied the charge times the electric field. There's going to be magnetic forces too. But we want to change this force, where we integrated over the elephant, into a equivalent, equal formula, where I'm in fact calculating the force on any Gaussian surface that surrounds the elephant. Okay, so that's the plan, and here's kind of the final story. The time rate of change in the momentum, that's going to be the force, plus the momentum that's in the electromagnetic field, that's going to equal what we get when we integrate up over a surrounding surface, this stress tensor. And if we look up here, we see that the stress tensor has kind of a natural form. It's going to have every place EI times EJ. So this is, again, the usual notation where I and J are representing the rows and columns of the matrix. So for example, the first row, second column, is going to have an entry that is EX times EY. Okay, and notice that there's a whole lot of symmetry between what's going on with the magnetic field and what's going on with the electric field, even though the force equation is really different between the magnetic field and the electric field. So this is kind of another way of seeing that the electric and magnetic field are all kind of part and parcel of the same thing. When we write forces in terms of the stress tensor, they do all look pretty much the same. So, okay, so here's the starting point, the formula for the force on an object, right? So if there is current flowing in that object, then we're going to have the V cross B force. If there is charge on the object, then we're going to have the charge density times the electric field. And this is all the force per volume. So to get the total force, I'm going to have to integrate this over the volume of the elephant. So the plan is to turn this equation into a equation that just involves the electric and magnetic field. So we want to get rid of the rho and the j and substitute in the equations that tell us what rho and j are in terms of d and h. So what we know is that the charge density is, by Gauss's law, is equal to epsilon naught times the divergence of the electric field. So incidentally, we're doing all of this in vacuum. So we're not going to worry about the epsilon and epsilon naughts. Does this all look out of focus to you guys slightly, or is it just my nearsighted, farsighted? Hard to tell. Okay. So what we have for the current density is the equation that the curl of H is equal to J plus the time derivative of D. So we want to get this equation in terms of J. So what we're going to have is that J is equal to the curl of H, and H is, of course, 1 over mu naught times B, and minus the time derivative of D, and D is epsilon naught times E. So we've plugged that in right here. And here you can see the curl dot B is giving us that J, but we also have this time derivative of D that's going along for the ride. Okay, so what follows is a bunch of vector identities, which we're going to go through because it's good to see it proved. So what we're going to do here is we're going to substitute this basically for that. So if we take the time derivative of E cross B, which I hope you recognize as the pointing vector, we get a term like we've got, but we also get a term like we didn't really want. And we can rewrite the time derivative of B using induction to give us the curl of E. Okay, so this, we have a term that's the time derivative of B, and again, Maxwell's equation tells us that the curl of E is equal to minus the time derivative of B. So where are we? Okay, so here's the curl of E. Minus sign has come in from this plus sign, and this is the term that we've in fact got up there. So if we plug this all in, here's the charge density. The curl of E is coming from this term here, and it has a positive sign because we put it on the other side of the equation. And here we have a 1 over mu naught, and we've got this term here, which is the curl of B is the J, basically. Where did this term come from? There is no such term, right? That's spotted from no place. And that's okay because the divergence of B is exactly equal to zero. So I can add that in for free. The reason we added it in is now we have exactly the same formula for the electric and the magnetic field. So we can just manipulate one of these guys, and we know that the same manipulations are going to change this guy around in the same fashion. And you can see that in the end, what we get is a symmetric formula for E and B. So we should be good to go. Okay, so the starting point is this guy here, the curl of E crossed E. And what we want to do is to show that it has this particular form. So let's take a look at that guy. So we've got the curl of E crossed into E, and just for practice, we're looking at the ith component of that. So if I know what the ith component is, I being x, y, z as it were, I'll be all set in order to figure out what it is going to be for any old value. So here's where we start using our epsilon ijk's. So what we have, if we have A cross B, the ith component of it, that's equal to epsilon I AJ BK, epsilon IJK, AJ BK, where we're summing using Einstein's notation on all of the J's and K's. And what this A is, it's of course itself a cross product. It's the curl of E. So what we're going to have here is going to be, well, we want the jth component of it. So this is going to be epsilon j, and let me call them lowercase a, lowercase b, the derivative with respect to A and the corresponding electric field. Okay, so if I rewrite what I've got epsilon J A B, derivative with respect to A of E B, and I've got epsilon I J K. It's a perfectly good epsilon. E K. Okay, so now we have to try and simplify this form. And we're basically using the back cab formula, except in terms of these epsilons as opposed to other sorts of things. So let's just focus on the epsilon sort of term. So what I've got here is epsilon JAB. And I think it's going to be easier to think about this with the J in the front position. And you remember, I can rotate those guys around without changing the value. And just for fun, I'm going to remind you that we're adding up over all of those j's, right? Any repeated index is being summed over. So j is going to equal respectively 1, 2, and 3. So what values of a and b are going to give us non-zero values? Well, certainly A and B have to be different, because if they were the same, they would give us zero. And if we're thinking about J, for example, being one, it must be that A and B have to be 2 and 3, and K and I also have to be 2 and 3. And the only question is the order. So if K is the same as A and B is the same as I, then we're going to get an epsilon. Who knows whether that epsilon is plus or minus, but it's squared. So it's going to be plus 1. So I'm going to for sure get a plus value, a plus 1 value, if A equals K and B equals I. On the other hand, the other possibility, if this is 1, is this might be 2 and 3, and this might be 3 and 2. That's also going to be a non-zero value. And if you think about it, it's guaranteed to be minus 1, because one of those is in the right order and one of them is in the wrong order. So this has to be equal to minus delta A being equal to I and delta B being equal to K. Okay, so this is the sort of general formula you can have tattooed, because it's useful under lots of different circumstances. And it's basically the same thing as BATCAB, but written in terms of these Einstein summation notation as opposed to the other sorts of things. Okay, so let's plug in our formula here. Well, it's not bother to plug it in, because I'd have to rewrite it. This is all being multiplied by the derivative with respect to A of EB and the electric field in the K direction. So one possibility is that A is equal to K and B is equal to I. So this term here under those circumstances is going to be the electric field times A derivative with respect to A, because K has to equal A, and then we're going to get the electric field in the ith direction. The other term, what's going to happen there is A is going to equal I and B is going to equal K. So what we're going to have is EB derivative with respect to the ith coordinate times EB.
When is this?
So we're just dealing with this term. And if we add up delta AI EI, we're summing over I, then this is mostly going to be 0 unless I is equal to A. So if we do that sort of sum, what we get is EA. Right? Makes perfectly good sense. That's the sort of thing I'm using here in doing these sums. So what we said under these circumstances was that B had to equal I. Well, there it is. B has to equal I. And this K and this A had to be the same. Are we happy with that or not? We're cogitating.
Sure, we can be happy. Okay, what are we doing?
So what we're trying to do is to go from this to that. And the particular step we're working on is this step here.
And what are those deltas?
Say again?
What are those deltas?
So those deltas are what we call Kronecker deltas. They have, so we have those deltas and epsilons. So delta of ij is, generally speaking, it's equal to 0. It's equal to 1 if I equals j. So, for example, delta 1, 2 is equal to 0, and delta 2, 2 is equal to 1.
Okay,
so,
right?
We've done all of this before. So, if we do this sort of sum, then obviously this is a sum of nothing unless I happens to equal A, in which case what we're going to get out is this, right? So, all we're doing is using that sort of thing repeatedly.
Okay, and so is that
Yeah, someplace there was a partial with respect to A.
In the green, where is that component
playing with the element? So this was, so we started with this term here.
Yeah.
And we rewrote it over here.
Yeah.
And what we did is we just dealt with the epsilon separately.
Okay.
And for the epsilon separately, we got this formula.
Okay.
And now I just bring back the other terms, right? So we had three other terms, there they are. Okay, this time maybe okay, really? It might help if I rewrite this kind of in terms of vector notation. So here what I have is E dot grad operating on E. And here what I have, and there's a minus sign here. This one is hard to write in terms of dot product notation, which is kind of why we haven't written it in terms of dot product notation. But I can write it a little bit easier if I bring the B inside the derivative. And if you think about it, what that term is it's 1/2 of derivative with respect to I of EB squared. Because if I take the derivative of that, the 2 comes down, cancels a half, and I get, in fact, exactly that. So this term here, I can write in terms of vector notation in a reasonably good form. That's going to be the gradient of 1/2 of E squared. And do notice that this is the whole E vector squared because we're adding up all of these B's, right? So we're adding up B being 1, 2, 3. So we're going to get the whole E vector squared when we do that. Okay. So that was for this piece,
okay, yeah.
And this was for that piece. And there's a minus sign between them. So if I were going to rewrite this thing totally, what I would get would be E dot grad. So that's a scalar operator that's going to operate separately on the x, y, and z components of the electric field. And I get minus the grad of 1/2 E squared. Okay, and that's exactly the same thing as what's written here if you look at what's denoted there. So here we have, I called this, boy, that sure looks out of focus to me. So that EJ is what I called EB, and here's the gradient part of it, and here's the dot product of E and the grad giving us this E. Okay. So this was all this term here. We got this term here too, right? So if we put those pieces together, so this term here is E times the gradient of E. There's the gradient, or excuse me, the divergence, right? Remember that we're summing over any repeated index. So this quantity here is the divergence of E times E, and here is what we had just up there. And it works exactly the same way with the B field. Right, there's no reason to redo that algebra with the B field. Okay, so we're finally at the final step. Take a look at these middle terms. So this one is EI, EJ derivative with respect to XJ, and here we have EI, EJ derivative with respect to XJ. So that's just the product rule on this guy here. Okay, and the other term, of course, is following kind of automatically from the usual properties of the delta function, right? This is the delta ij summing on j just gives me the derivative with respect to I, and we get the 1/2 that we've got there. Okay, so this is kind of the final form. What we've said then is that the force per volume can be written as the divergence of that matrix T. So what we've got then is the force in a particular direction can be calculated by the divergence of that quantity T. And then we've got minus epsilon naught, the time derivative of the pointing vector, well, basically the pointing vector. Pointing vector is actually E cross H. Okay, so for this term here, so to get the total force, what we need to do is to integrate the force per volume times dV. And if we do that with the divergence, this term here is going to be, can be converted to a surface integral of T dot N dA. Exactly what we've been thinking about. Okay, so if we kind of flip back to the sheet, so what we've got is, rearranging this, the force is the time rate of change of the momentum of the charges that are being acted on, and we've shown that that's equal to the surface integral of this, and we're going to take this term to the other side of the equation, and then we have total momentum, the field momentum plus the momentum in the charges, is the surface integral of this stress tensor. Okay. So I don't hear cheering. So, I don't know, what's the point? So there are kind of two points, and one is that you really do want to start to become proficient with this sort of game where we're playing with these epsilons and j's. It's really the only way you can start to play with complicated formulas, so you're starting to see some of that. And the other claim was to see that we really can think of the forces on the electric field as being kind of like the forces on this fish, where we've got a stress tensor. And the third thing we got out of this was the formula for the momentum per unit volume. So the momentum per unit volume is just this, wherever it is, this term here, closely related to the S vector. Well, so how can we relate this to the S vector? Well, I guess I won't go there. Let's do an example. And I think the example is going to demonstrate how practically useless this formula is. So it's really good for theory, but typically if you actually want to calculate forces, there's going to be an easier way of doing it. Okay. So let's deal with the following situation. I have a positive charge Q, and I've got a negative charge Q, and they're separated by some distance, which I'm going to call 2D. And boy, I don't even know if we have to go to 200. It may probably go back to high school in order to calculate this force, right? So the force, according to Coulomb's law, is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, the product of the charges divided by the distance squared. So we're going to do that the hard way. We're going to find that same answer the hard way. And of course, it's an attractive force. So how are we going to do this? Well, in order to calculate the force on this positively charged particle, I need to surround it by a Gaussian surface and do that surface integral. So I'm going to choose a Gaussian surface which bisects these two positive and negative charges, and I'm going to have it close at infinity. So if we just think about what's happening at infinity, we know that the electric fields are proportional to 1 over r squared, and the stress tensor has the electric field squared in it, so it's going to go like 1 over r to the fourth. Roughly speaking, what we're going to get for this surface integral is going to be the electric field times the area of this half sphere, which is going to be 2 pi r squared. And so the upshot of this is that integral goes to 0 as r goes to infinity. So we don't actually have to calculate what's going on at that infinite surface. We only have to calculate what's going on at this plane that bisects these two charges. Okay, so what is the electric field on the plane that bisects these two charges? Well, this positive charge is going to make an electric field that points directly away from it, kind of like that. And this negative charge is going to make an electric field that points right towards it, kind of like that. And the magnitude of those electric fields is going to be the same because they're the same distance. And the angles are kind of equal and opposite. So the net electric field is going to be pointing totally in the horizontal direction. So what, and we might as well call that the x direction. So what does that say about the stress tensor? So you remember that the stress tensor in terms of these electric fields was epsilon naught, and then we had EI times EJ minus, along the diagonal, we had E squared, the whole vector squared. So what elements are going to be present in this stress tensor? Well, let's start with the 1-1 component, because that's going to be, as you'll see in a minute, the most important component. So for 1-1, we're going to get the electric field in the x direction squared, which is the whole electric field. There's only an electric field in the x direction. And then we're going to subtract off half of it. So what we're going to have here is plus 1/2 the whole electric field, which is all in the x direction. If we go next down the diagonal to the 2-2 component, there's no electric field in the y direction. So there's 0 here, but there's still going to be minus 1/2 the electric field. And the same thing applies to the z direction. In terms of the off-diagonal elements, they're all going to be 0. Right? Because in order to get something non-zero, I have to choose I or j equal to the x. And if it's off diagonal, the other one can't be x, and the only component is going to be in the x direction. So this is what the stress tensor looks like. It's diagonal, and it has positive coefficient in the x direction and negative in the other directions.
That's EI.
Yeah, so this is EI, EJ. And for example, this element of this matrix would be the 1, 2, I equals 1, J equals 2 element of that matrix. Okay. So in order to calculate this force, we need to dot this with a unit vector that's in the x direction. And what we're going to get is, boom, 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 we're going to get a vector that is 1/2 E squared in the x direction and 0 in the y and z directions, right? Which is what we expect. The force better be only in the x direction, and that's what we've got when we do that dot product. Okay, so to find the net force in the x direction, all I need to do now is to do the surface integral of this thing. It's kind of like electric pressure, you might call it, times the surface area of these pieces. That's an x. Just looks like a y. Okay, so the whole problem is cylindrically symmetric. So what I'm going to be interested in is this distance. I'm going to call it r, that we are from the midpoint between those two things. And we do need to distinguish that from, you know, what we would normally call r, which is the distance that we would have to that point of interest. And for that, I'm going to call that script r, if I can find a pen that writes better. So what's the formula for this electric field? The overall magnitude of either the green or the red electric field is going to be 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught q squared over script r squared, right? But we only want the x component of that electric field. So we need to multiply that formula by the cosine of this angle. And we can conveniently calculate the cosine of that angle because it's opposite over hypotenuse. So we need to get the cosine of that angle, which is just d over script r. And of course, everything is twice as big because not only do I have the green arrow, I've got the red arrow.
Can you scooch up? Are you
up
squared?
Or down?
Oh,
q squared.
64.
Say again?
Your equations for the electric field and the force look very similar.
Similar, but different enough that it's not going to work. Oh, thank you. Okay, so there is a mistake here. No Q squared, right? Electric fields are charge. So you might wonder where the Q squared is going to come from. Well, the formula has an electric field squared. But now you're going to wonder about how those denominators and numerators are going to all work out. Okay, so let's at least write the formula once for what this electric field is. So the electric field without the square is going to be 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. Just one Q. We've got a script R cubed in the denominator, and we've got a 2D.
What is that?
So that's what the electric field is, this whole black electric field. And I did drop the epsilon naught that is in the stress tensor. Okay, so in terms of my normal sort of R, my script R, that's equal to R squared plus D squared, right?
Yeah,
so R script squared, just so you don't have to write it as a square root. So that's just Pythagorean theorem, right? That's an R script, yep. Cubed. And the cube came from the square and then the piece of cosine. So the thing is cylindrically symmetrical, so I can integrate this in a bullseye pattern around that center area. So I can use for my area 2 pi r dr. And then I want to integrate that for this r going from 0 to infinity. Okay, so what do I got going here? So I've got epsilon naught. I'm supposed to integrate this for r from 0 to infinity of 1 half e squared. And e squared is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught q times 2d. And then we have r squared plus d squared cube to the 3 halves, excuse me. Yep, that's all true. We got all of that squared, and then we've got our 2 pi r dr.
On the numerator, it's q.
So this is q times 2d. Okay? And I repeat, this is the long way of coming up with this answer, right? This is the answer that we're hoping this integral is.
You did this a long way another time.
Say again? Long way too. Yeah, yeah. There are lots of ways of doing things the hard way. So why bother? Well, if it's the easy way, it's in a textbook, right, already. And it's probably not the problem that you want solved in real life. Okay, so what do we got? So we only want one epsilon naught in the denominator. We got two, but we got one to cancel. So that's kind of looking good. We only want 1 4 pi in the denominator, and we got 2 because it's squared. We've got a 2 pi here, and we've got a 1 half there, and we've got a 4 there because it's 2 squared. So this 4 and that 4 can cancel off, this pi and that pi can cancel off, and that 2 can cancel off. So I'm going to have left over just 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, which is kind of what I want, right? So again, one of these epsilon naught gets killed there. This 2 gets killed by that 2. And this 2 squared kills one of these 4s. OK, so what I've got left over then is the integral from 0 to infinity. And what I have left over is q squared d squared. I took care of the 2. So what I have left over then is r dr from the range of integration. I used up the 2 pi already. And then I've got r squared plus d squared cubed, right? Because 3 halves halved. No, the 2 I took care of earlier. Okay, so obviously we want to use a change of variables. We want to get a du for that. So I want to put in a 1/2 and put in a 2. So I've got a du. And then the antiderivative is clear. The antiderivative of this, I hope you can see, is r squared plus d squared to the minus 2 divided by minus 2. Just like usual. And we want to evaluate this from 0 to infinity. Okay, so infinity is going to give us 0. The minus sign that is intrinsic in the order here is going to get rid of that minus sign. So what I've got is q squared d squared over 4 pi epsilon naught. I got 2 2's here, so that's going to be 2 squared. And when I plug in r equals 0, what I'm going to get is d to the 4th. And I hope you can see we're there. So this is infinity and 0, right? We want to integrate from r going from 0 to infinity. Okay, so I did 1. You get to do 2 for homework. The ones I have you do for homework work very similar to this, except now we're going to have line charges. So that'll deal with the electric field case, and then we'll have wires that are carrying currents on either side. So they'll work out kind of similar but different. Okay. Going. So stress tensors, useful in theory, useful to show that light carried momentum, useful to practice our epsilon ijk stuff. Yes. Yep. So you don't need to ever reprove that. I've proven it. I filled in the missing steps that are in that.
So are we also using this field momentum density and this momentum conservation?
So another one of the homework problems talks about so-called solar sailing. So the idea is that if we put a big mirror in space, when the sunlight bounces off of it, it's got momentum. So we have momentum that's going this way and then it's ricocheting back. So that can push the solar sail forward. So you're going to need that momentum density in order to solve that solar sailing problem. Okay, so light carries momentum and energy. So what's next? So you remember, I gave you warning that unless you told me otherwise, what I was going to talk about was radiation.
Nobody said anything.
Radiation, which is to say how radio waves are made, right? I'm not thinking about bad radiation. And relativity. And I've got 5 minutes, so we can certainly get someplace.
That's the word relativity.
That's the word relativity. An arrow. Okay, so the radiation formulas also pretty quickly lead to a mess of algebra, but there is one formula that is memorable and difficult to derive that you absolutely need to see and know and love, and that's the simple formula for the power that is radiated when we have an accelerating charge. So I hope you know that the source of electromagnetic radiation is an accelerating charge. Just a moving charge isn't enough in order to make light. You have to have an accelerating charge. So in kind of the standard example, if you have a radio antenna, you're going to send the charge up and down that radio antenna, and that's what's going to be produce the acceleration that is going to make the radio light. If you have an atom that has one of these electron clouds that is a stable pattern of charge, as it moves to a different different standing wave pattern of charge, it turns out that it also has accelerating charge, and that's what's making the photon of light that comes from that transition as you go from level A to level B. So it turns out there's, a simple and memorable formula for what the power is in the case of non-relativistic motion. And for non-relativistic motion, the power radiated is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. We're kind of used to seeing those things. It's going to depend on the charge squared and the acceleration squared, and the famous factor of 2/3, and the rest of it is just powers of C. I think it's a C cubed, but I want to check. A C cubed. Okay, so it's a real simple plug and chug, useful sort of formula for the power that's radiating from an accelerated charge particle, non-relativistically. If we look at the pattern of light that is produced by an accelerated charge, so if the acceleration is that way, then the light wants to come out perpendicular to that acceleration. So it's kind of like in a donut that would surround that accelerating charge particle. It would be coming as much out of the page and into the page and over to the right. Not so much would be coming out at an angle, and zero would be coming out in a direction that is parallel to the electric and magnetic field. So a standard and quick application of this is the following: Thompson scattering cross section. Probably the single most important formula for the radiation. So the picture we've got is that we've got waves of light, which of course have electric fields that are going this way, and we've got a charged particle, which I'm usually thinking about being an electron, but it's going to have some charge Q. And quite naturally, what's going to happen is when this light reaches this charged particle is going to oscillate back and forth. And because it is accelerating, it's going to be producing scattered light. We can think about what's happening as the electron having some finite cross-section, and the light that is going to hit that finite cross-section is going to be scattered in a new direction. Okay, so this is kind of an effective cross-sectional area of any charged particle. What's really happening is the charged particle is bouncing around and it's therefore radiating, but we can think about what's happening as the energy that is going to hit that charged particle is going to be re-radiated. Yeah, so really what's happening is the light is accelerating the particle, and that acceleration is producing new light. But kind of a different way of thinking about it is that the light is hitting this shiny sphere that has some radius, and an equivalent amount of light is going off in all directions. So this is kind of it's not a real radius of an electron, it's an effective radius of electron if we thought about it as scattering light in that way. So acceleration, deceleration, it's no different. So, and I guess I'm not so much worried about heating up or cooling down. In some arbitrary sense, of course, what's happening with thermal radiation is we have objects that are vibrating because they're hot, and they're accelerating and therefore producing light by this mechanism. But that way of thinking about it is probably not the right way to think about it, because there are general thermodynamic arguments that tell you how much light is going to be radiating, and basically it doesn't depend on the material at all. So that's thermodynamics, and you can ask these guys. They know about Planck and his discovery of the formula for the light that's radiated. Doesn't really depend on the material properties at all. Okay, so this is actually a pretty simple process. We can calculate out what the acceleration is of this charged particle, right? It's charge divided by the mass times the electric field. And we know about the energy per area that's in this light, right? That's the pointing vector. That's equal to 1 over mu naught c times the electric field squared. Right, so this is watts per square meter, watts singular per square meter. If I take the power that's radiated, the watts, and divide it by the watts per square meter, what I'm going to get is an effective cross-sectional area of this electron. And it's just a matter of plug and chugging. Notice that the electric field intensity is going to cancel top and bottom. So this effective cross-section doesn't depend on the intensity of the light. And it really is just a plug and chug. And I'll just tell you what the answer is. The answer is 8 pi over 3 times what's called the classical radius of an electron squared. So what's the classical radius of an electron squared? The classical radius of the electron is the radius that an electron would have if 100% of its mass energy equivalent was electromagnetic energy. So we know that electromagnetic energy is q squared over 4 pi epsilon naught r. If that energy was equal to the rest mass of an electron, we have a formula then for what the so-called classical radius of an electron is. And it turns out to be on the order of 10 to the minus 15th meters, which is about the size of a nucleus, which is a totally random fact. There's no relationship between those two facts. But way smaller than an atom. Okay, so Thompson scattering is the scattering of light off free charged particles, typically electrons. And the fraction of light that's scattered depends on the classical radius of the electron squared. Incidentally, I don't like that formula. That's the way everyone writes that formula. I like to write it in terms of the Compton radius squared. So this is C for classical. This is C for Compton. Compton is a famous dead physicist. Classical is not a famous dead physicist. I like Arthur Holly Compton. He's a nice guy. The Compton radius of an electron, it really is something like the radius of an electron. And it's given by h divided by the mass of an electron times c. And this alpha, you probably haven't run into before, but it deserves to be a famous dead physicist. It's called the fine structure constant, and it occurs all over advanced physics. And it's a small number. It's about 137th. So I don't know, the last version, so this is the version that's in the book. If you go looking for the formula in the book, that's what's there. Okay, so help session tomorrow, exam.